and welcome to this week's Ukraine Calling program. I'm Oksana Smirchuk for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv. We'll have a roundup of the weekly news for you, some culture and some music. And we're bringing you a feature interview with Andrew Tkach and Bohdan Onishchuk, talking about a new documentary film on the Holodomor and about a Canadian, Rhea Kleiman, who was one of the first to report on it. But first, the news. There were some dramatic scenes in Kyiv this week as former Odessa region governor Mikhail Saakashvili was arrested, only to be freed by determined throngs of supporters. Police conducted a search of Saakashvili's apartment early Tuesday morning, 5th of December, leading the politician to try to flee via the roof of the building. He was detained and put in an SBU van, but the crowds of his supporters clashed with police and helped him to escape the van. He then continued with the crowds onto the tent city outside the Verkhovna Rada, where he led rallies, vowing to fight corruption and calling for removal of the government in power and for impeachment. That same day, Ukraine's prosecutor general, Yuri Lutsenko, held a press briefing where he claimed that the government had evidence that Mikhail Saakashvili was being financed by persons linked to ex-president Viktor Yanukovych. He named Ukrainian oligarch Sergei Kurchenko, an associate of Yanukovych who had fled to Russia, as allegedly financing Saakashvili in order to stir up protests aimed at seizing power. This would assist Yanukovych and associates to resume control over the assets they had had in Ukraine. Saakashvili has called the charges and the evidence against him fake. President Poroshenko commented to say that Saakashvili's actions were aimed at destabilizing the situation in the country. This week, Ukrainian activists and reformist lawmakers worked together to save NABU, the National Anti-Corruption Bureau, from what seemed to be a government attempt to disarm anti-corruption reform. The Verkhovna Rada had registered a bill drafted by the bloc Petro Poroshenko Party and Arseniy Yatsenyuk's party, which would give the parliament and the president the right to dismiss the director of NABU. International financial institutions and other Western partners expressed concern that this move would be rolling back on reforms. The bill was to be put to the vote in parliament on December the 7th, but activists and reformist legislators mobilized through social networks and the bill was removed from the agenda. Later in the day, however, there was a different setback when, in a separate vote, the Verkhovna Rada voted to dismiss the head of the Parliamentary Anti-Corruption Committee, Yehor Sobolev. And in the meantime, President Poroshenko urged the Ukrainian parliament to expedite the creation of an anti-corruption court and proposed to table the draft law himself. This week, the Verkhovna Rada passed a law on domestic violence, which makes it punishable now under Ukrainian criminal law, thus making offenders liable to more serious consequences. The law will serve to protect the victims of physical, psychological, or economic violence in the family. According to data provided by UNIAN, some 165,000 women report domestic violence annually, although the real figures are estimated to be five times higher. The new legislation makes provisions for financing of women's shelters, creation of rehab programs for victims, and psychological and legal support for victims. According to the official data announced by the Ukrainian President Poroshenko on December the 7th, since the beginning of the anti-terrorist operation in eastern Ukraine, Ukrainian forces have lost more than 2,750 people. During the first week of December, the situation on the front line remained unchanged. Ukrainian officials reported constant shelling of Ukrainian positions by pro-Russian forces, which usually intensified during the night. On December the 2nd, pro-Russian forces reportedly shelled residential areas of the settlements of Vodyane, Avdiivka, Verkhnyotoretske, all in Donetsk region, and there was one civilian casualty. And on December the 6th, pro-Russian forces shelled Ukrainian positions near the settlement of Novoselivka, also in Donetsk region, and shelled with mortars. Officials are reporting that some of the shelling that was used against the Ukrainian army contained phosphorus. Over the first week of December, the Ukrainian army lost one soldier killed in action and 12 were wounded. Ukrainian political prisoner Viktor Baluch has been placed under house arrest. He had been previously held in pretrial detention for a year. Russia's FSB had detained him exactly a year ago on fabricated charges of allegedly holding stockpiles of bullets and explosives. The case has been widely criticized by human rights groups who say that the explosives were planted. And Viktor Baluch maintains that he has been detained because of his pro-Ukrainian stance. And now for our feature interview. Bohdan Mihailo speaks to filmmaker Andrew Tkach and Bohdan Onyshchuk about a new Holodomor awareness project.
Well, welcome to our weekly in-depth discussion. We've just been commemorating the latest anniversary of the Holodomor, the genocide through artificial famine, a man-made famine, Stalin's famine in Ukraine. And I'm very fortunate and privileged to have with me today two people who've really made a great effort and contribution in getting this theme known not only in Ukraine but in the outside world. First, I have Bohdan Onyshchuk, who is the chair of the Holodomor National Awareness Tour and has been responsible for various documentaries and films and publications. More on that later. Andrew Tkach, a filmmaker, veteran filmmaker, a film director, long-standing aide to the very famous Christiane Annapour from CNN.
You would say, yes, I produced all her long-form documentaries for 13 years.
And you also more recently produced a film on the Maidan, and now we'll be talking about the latest film about the Holodomor, which has a new novel angle to it. But more on that when we get into the discussion. We'll start with Bohdan. Bohdan, you're a lawyer by background.
Yes.
Eminent lawyer, QC, as we see. How did you get involved in the theme of the Holodomor many years ago, not just now?
Well, I mean, having grown up as a Ukrainian-Canadian in Canada and having emigrated as a small baby from Lviv with my parents and my brother, the rest of it, I think, is pretty clear that we tried to carry on not just the tradition, but the good news in terms of and keep the Ukrainian language and history alive. I immediately got involved with the Ukrainian community organizations, and through that, all of the main efforts in terms of what are the big issues, and particularly in this case, Holodomor, which was denied up until 1991.
Tell us a little bit more about the early days, the very first documentary that was made in Canada by the Ukrainian Canadian community.
Right. That's why we set up the Ukrainian Canadian Documentation Center in Toronto in 1981. We were coming up to the 50th anniversary of commemorating the Holodomor, and at that point, the Soviet Union was still denying that any famine had existed, never mind a genocide. And, of course, the Ukrainian community had carried the story, with them all the way from Europe, which was that this was a genocide and this was a huge famine. And so we decided that this was the time to try and do a major documentary. So the UCRDC, as it came to be known, which was the Documentation Center, was incorporated. I was one of the founders of it. I was the vice chair for about 15 years after that. But
this initiative was supported by the community, by private donors?
It was both, but it was basically, it had all the heavy hitters from the main organizations in Canada.
Did this coincide with what the Harvard Ukrainian Institute was trying to do with James Mace and with Robert Conquest?
Well, James Mace actually came a little bit later, but yes, it absolutely did, and we were very close with James. He was a terrific guy. And Robert Conquest, we found him in England, and why his book is called Harvest of Sorrow, it was a takeoff on our film, which came out 3 years before that, Harvest of Despair, which won 7 documentary golds. And it was through Malcolm Muggeridge who actually we got to Robert Conquest, Bob Conquest. And of course, he'd done one of the major works in terms of, you know, the Soviet Union and Stalin's deeds and all the rest of it. So.
Right. Well, I had the privilege of knowing both Robert Conquest and Malcolm Muggeridge, and James was a very good friend. But, of course, the challenge then was how to get awareness of what had happened in Ukraine in 32, 33 out to the outside world, right, to a skeptical world, to a leftist audience very often that didn't want to accept that this could have happened, that, you know, that there were, shall we say, technical issues, issues with the climate, with a failure of the harvest or whatever. Jumping ahead, have we made much progress in the last 30 years in getting this across?
Oh, I think absolutely. I mean, Harvest of Despair was a great start because, being a lawyer, and there were other lawyers on the original committee and on Doc Center, we knew we had to get facts, like hard facts. And because we were coming up to the 50th anniversary, we also were coming up to 50 years is typically in diplomatic terms when they released their archives. So we knew there were going to be Italian archives released because they had a consulate in Kharkiv. We knew that there were German archives being released, and the British archives from Moscow were being released. So we focused on those, and we found a treasure trove.
I know. But again, the challenge was to interest those who weren't Ukrainians in it. And I'm going to turn now to Andrew. Andrew, you come from this filmmaking background. What got you interested in this latest project? And tell us a little bit about it. What is the novelty about this film, if you could introduce it, that we've just seen a screening of in the Verkhovna Rada, in the Parliament of Ukraine today?
Well, basically, I had produced a film in Ukraine just after Maidan with the local filmmaking group here, Babylon 13. And I think that came to the attention of the Canada-Ukraine Foundation, and that's how they knew about me. So they came to me, and I'm working in Africa now in Kenya. So, you know, they came to me and said, look, we have this project, and we'd like you to be one of the competitors for it. You know, can you take a look at it? And I was quite skeptical at first because I'm a filmmaker dealing with real life, not past life, especially people who were, you know, unknown, no material on them, you know, no documentary, you know, material. But they sent me the articles that Yoris Balan had found, and I read them, and I found her voice to be interesting. In other words, for me as a filmmaker, what is interesting is not is, of course, the bigger story, but also
Yoris Balan, I should add, is a Ukrainian scholar based in Edmonton. Now, what did he discover?
There were two dozen articles written in Rhea Kleiman's own voice, and she was very descriptive.
Can you introduce her? Who is she?
Rhea Kleiman was a 20-something journalist who went to Moscow pretty much penniless. We know that when she first got there, she slept in the bathtub of somebody she met on the train. She was an adventurer, very much a leftist.
Canadian-Jewish?
Yes.
Woman?
Yes, who came there, like many people at that period, with the idea that they were about to witness the new society being born.
Like Malcolm Muggeridge from Britain.
Yes. Unlike the rest of the people, because she was poor and was not supported by New York Times or anybody else, she was a freelancer. She got a room in a komunalka, you know, a common apartment, and learned Russian very quickly, and also lived like other people did, probably not much better. We also know that her boyfriend was arrested for currency speculation and sent to the Arctic, you know, to Siberia. So that is why she went up there, you know.
But why is she the subject of a film about the Holodomor?
Well, because one of the great coincidences of her career is that after they discovered that she had written about the Stalin penal labor camps, they were about to kick her out. And she somehow convinced two American women who showed up in Moscow at a car and heard the rumors that there was a tremendous famine going on. And like a good journalist, she convinced them to get in the car and drive through the famine zone.
But this is exceptional because she was working, Bogdana, as an assistant to
Walter Duranty. I was just going to add, I think Andrew just skipped that part. But yeah, when she came back from the tundra, She spent 8 months working as the assistant to Walter Duranty.
And who was Walter Duranty? Remind our listeners.
Walter Duranty was the big liar who basically took the Soviet
lie. Working for the New York Times,
Working for the New York Times, won the Pulitzer Prize, the correspondent that everybody kowtowed to in Moscow and back in North America, but who, you know, fed the big lie.
Was a fibber, yes.
Was a fibber. Big time, and but to her credit, and to answer your question to Andrew, she was the kind of journalist, which is why we wanted to make this film with her. She was the kind of journalist who she wanted to get at the truth. She wasn't about, and she saw that Duranty was lying, and she saw that the Soviet Union leadership was lying. They were calling it Valhalla and the next, millennium
utopia. A workers' utopia.
Yeah, all she saw was bread lines, food lines, out in the city in Moscow and outside. I mean, the place was collapsing. I mean, it was certainly not anything approaching any utopia or anything else.
So she, despite being an invalid herself, Andrew has told me that she only had one leg due to an accident in childhood, yes? And she courageously, with two other women, three women, driving across the Soviet Union south to Georgia, through Ukraine, through the famine-stricken regions, through the Caucasus, and ending up in Georgia and witnessing these horrible scenes. And have we found much that adds to the story of the Holodomor?
Oh, a lot. Because, first of all, she was the first journalist to write about it. She was there first, before Jones, before Muggeridge. Not by a lot, but by, you know, 2-3 months in terms of Jones, and about 5 or 6 months in terms of Muggeridge. And she wrote about it. But she wanted to see for herself what the situation was in Ukraine, which was then part of the Soviet Union, of course, and to be able to see whether, in fact, what everybody was talking about the back rooms in Moscow was, in fact, true, which was that there's, quote, a famine going on, but nobody could get any passage and couldn't get any visas to go into the country. So she did it with a couple of American heiresses who had this fabulous car. You know, sort of,
two bottles of champagne.
And two bottles of champagne, and away they went.
Well, okay, so they made this trip. She gets arrested the film tells us when they arrive in Tbilisi. She's kicked out of the Soviet Union, writes these incredible articles for a London newspaper and for a Toronto newspaper.
Now, what's interesting is actually that there were no restrictions on journalists before she was kicked out. You know, it's only in reaction to her reporting and one or two other reports that there is, you know, documentation that Stalin says we cannot have more of this. You know, so she went there without a minder. And because she spoke Russian, she could operate freely in the country.
What makes the film so interesting as well is that she, being of Jewish origin, reports about the famine in Ukraine. After she gets back, instead of being totally disillusioned and cynical, she publishes these articles and then applies for a job as a correspondent in Nazi Germany and is reporting on the Nazis. And this is a remarkable story of a woman that reported on two horrendous crimes against humanity. The Holocaust hadn't happened in the 30s, but the Nazis were well on their way to showing their colors.
Yeah, she's quite cynical when she talks about it. She says, you know, I went to Canada and was given non-paying jobs with women's clubs making speeches. She's not somebody who had money, so she needed to go where the action was, she says, and the action was Nazi Germany. It's very much like a freelancer's kind of mentality, which I understand totally, having worked freelance for 5 years. So what was also interesting when I read the Nazi period, we didn't go into it in detail in the film, but she went to the border of Austria on a hunch before Hitler invaded Austria, and did it all through kind of personal connections with various SS officers she had met, you know, and, you know, even jokes in the book that, you know, she's meeting people who claim that they can smell somebody from Jewish origin. Well, clearly they couldn't, you know, and she was an enterprising, courageous person.
Yes, so amazing story. It would be, of course, remarkable if we managed to find in her writings or in her diaries or any papers, did she make any comparisons in the 30s between what she had witnessed, the totalitarian nature of the Soviet society and the growing totalitarian nature of the Nazi society? Yeah,
she did.
She did.
Yeah, because it says so in the film.
Yeah, but we're looking for her diaries, her notebooks. Yaroslav Balan, who did the script for us, is a historian and an academic at the University of Alberta, and he's into this big time. But we're trying to find her diaries. She, unfortunately, when she got back after the war, sort of got lost and passed away in White Plains, New York, many years later.
An unsung heroine in many ways.
An unsung heroine, absolutely right. But we're trying to find that because that would be a very interesting connection.
So we've been talking about Raya Kleiman, the subject of a new film, which is very aptly titled Hunger for Truth. Andrew, you're the producer and director of this film. Was it a difficult task to put all this together, to find a formula to make? Because what is also very interesting to those of you who have not seen the film yet is that it relates what happened in the 30s, specifically in the Holodomor, to what's happening today in Ukraine and the war with Russia and particularly the situation in the Donbas.
Yes. I mean, that was a difficult decision to make. I always felt, having worked in Ukraine and during the generation of Maidan, that you cannot, you know, there were so many tragedies in the 20th century that, you know, you can, people's eyes glaze over, you know, if you talk about another tragedy. You know, it doesn't have the same kind of relevance if you cannot relate it to today's conflict. So in terms of the script, I basically, once I received, you know, there was an outline from Yars, and it was basically a two-page outline with the 24 articles. And I just kind of locked myself up one weekend and wrote the Raya story totally from her own words. So the film does not have any narration. It's strictly her own words. The more complicated story was, how do we integrate what is happening today? Because disinformation is very much in the toolbox of demagogues now to what was happening then. So the key was to try to relate those two. One could easily have picked, you know, a journalist working today would have made more logical sense. But from a dramatical sense, I think it was better to take somebody who is actually a victim of the current conflict. And then disinformation is the backstory. But people, in effect, always relate better to personalities on screen than they do to
right.
abstract ideas.
Well, I hope we've whetted the appetite of those listening. But if somebody wants to see this film in the future, how would they go about it?
Well, get in touch with us. But we've put the film out for festivals, and so the premiere of it, because of the festivals that we're looking at, you can't sort of have a public showing or put it out into the mainstream theaters until after the festival. So that's going to happen in the early spring. But in the meantime, we're certainly for universities, for libraries, for documentation centers. We're making the DVD, which is done in 4K and has got phenomenal. I mean, one of the things I've got to add is Andrew and the team at Babylon 13 were phenomenal in terms of getting original archival footage from the time of not just Moscow and Ukraine, but also Tbilisi. Every aspect of it is historic, and that was a requirement from us if we could do it. But both with the Dozhenko studios and the stuff that's become available and open, it's an absolute knockout. So you'll have to wait until the spring for a public release.
Anyway, look, because time is running out, we seem, as Ukrainians, as people concerned about our past and where we are now, we seem to be in a much better position. We've just seen the publication of Anne Applebaum's book, Red Famine. We've seen the works by Timothy Snyder, putting things in a broader geopolitical context and temporal context. But what are the major tasks and priorities that await us? One of the questions that was asked today by the parliamentarians is how should we go about celebrating the 85th anniversary next year of the Holodomor? Is the task now to try and get it recognized as a genocide by as many countries as possible? Or what would you say are the priorities now?
Well, I think the recognition is halfway done. 17 of the major Western democracies have recognized it as a genocide, including Canada. Canada was about the fourth, I think, third or fourth. But the work isn't finished in that regard. But I think the next important priority, which was also discussed today, was the museum here in Kyiv. I mean, you've got the commemoration of Holodomor with the candle overlooking the Dnipro River, but phase two is the museum itself. And I think from what I've heard is that the Verkhovna Rada and the government would like to see at least the half of the museum being built before the end of 2018.
From my point of view, I'm not a propagandist. I'm a storyteller. That's what a journalist should be. When people, you know, ask why don't we have a particular message in the film, it's almost irrelevant to me. I mean, the film is about a person.
Yeah, it's a documentary,
you know,
right.
And the story has to hold up dramatically, has to hold up factually. But I'm not here to make the definitive treatment of the Holodomor. You know.
Okay. Well, look, we should mention finally, though we're speaking about what Canadian Ukrainians have been doing, American Ukrainians and others. I want to just, you know, pay tribute to the constant ongoing work, serious work that's being done by Ukrainian historians here. We've got here in the studio, and she's not taking part, she's a passive observer, Ludmila Hrinevich. I've got her big tome here about the chronicle of collectivization and the Holodomor in Ukraine, 27-33, volume two, just book one. I mean, a huge undertaking. So clearly, you know, in the last 25, 26 years, very substantial work has been done by historians in Ukraine to fill this hitherto blank spot, or shall we say suppressed spot. Any comments about that? Are you working closely with historians in Ukraine?
Well, we are. I mean, Hrek and Lyudmila Hrimevich is part of the Holodomor National Awareness Tour. Her bosses in Canada, which is where Hrek is founded, are part of our consortium, and we rely on them and we rely on the Doc Center for the research. But there's so much research out there. There's still a lot to be done, and it has to be done here because it happened here. You've got great historians here, and you've got the archives here. There are certain archives that are out in the West, but basically, there's a lot of research that should still that can happen, and books that need to be written.
Okay, Bohdan, I'll give the final word, as it were, to Andrew. Andrew, you made the effort of trying to link up the story of the Holodomor to the current situation and its challenges. So, for you personally, what are the lessons we draw from that terrible experience in our history?
I think the main lesson is that disinformation kills. Just like in Stalin's time, when there was denial of this massive tragedy, currently in the conflict with Russia, there is an absolute denial of the reality that there's an occupation force and that people are dying on a daily basis as well. That, you know, is very clearly, you know, brought out when we had Ludmila Hrinevich. She talked about the how during the Holodomor and the Holocaust, you know, first you had to actually debase the humanity of your victims. And the same thing you could say happens during disinformation today. When Russian media talks about, you know, Ukrainians, they refer to them in the most extreme language. And that allows, you know, people to go and volunteer for the Donbas effort and kill people. So it is not an abstract idea. It is something that causes real damage. And my role as a journalist is just to point to the truth as much as I can.
Well, thank you very much. This has been a fascinating discussion. I want to thank Andrew. You've just heard Andrew Tkach, who is, as I've introduced him, a filmmaker, film producer, now becoming a historian of sorts and a thinker on these topics, malgré lui. And I want to thank Bohdan Onishchuk, an eminent Canadian-Ukrainian lawyer, community activist, and one of the driving forces over several decades in getting the Holodomor message across and the story known. I thank you, gentlemen.
A new exhibit just opened in Kyiv's Mestetsky Arsenal. It's called Boychukism, a project about great style. Mykhailo Boychuk was an early 20th century painter who transformed Ukrainian art. His work caused a stir in Paris's Salon des Indépendants in 1910. And in 1917, he was one of the founders of Ukraine's Art Academy and had a huge impact on the art scene. The exhibit curators are Olga Melnik, Victoria Velichko, Igor Oksamitny. And this is how they describe it. This is a project about dreamers who wanted to change the world. This project is about the reformers of art who abandoned the traditional format. And this project is about the creators of utopia who themselves became its victims. So the exhibit is on until the 28th of January 2018. We'll post a link to it on our website. And in music, the Lviv group Sixth Sense, Shoste Chutya, recently released a new album. One of the songs I liked best was their contemporary rendition of the Ukrainian folk song Yak Priyecho, which means When I Got There. So enjoy.
Дай прив'язав коня до явора, а сам пішов до синього моря, а сам пішов до синього моря. Заболіла, заболіла голівонька зоря.
Next week, Bohdan Mykhailo will be hosting the show and we'll be back with even more news, culture and music. So tune in again for a new edition of Ukraine Calling. We would be happy to receive any feedback from you. You can write to us at ukrainecalling@hromadskeradio.org. This is Oksana Smerechuk in Kyiv. Thanks so much for listening.